From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the president's fixation on his inaugural crowd size, his unproven claims of voter fraud. How is this playing in Congress?
He's the president of the United States. Someday, he's got to grow up and accept the fact that he has huge responsibilities that go beyond making himself feel good every day.
We'll hear from the next head of Michigan's Republican Party.
You know, we can't fight each other, which there's been a tendency to do in both parties. Can't fight each other. We have to be focused on winning. And that's what my job is, to keep everybody focused.
Ypsilanti promises it won't ask immigration status.
There are so many times when it is not relevant for anyone to ask immigration status, and we are making sure that everyone who represents the city knows that.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With a White House freeze of EPA grants, what could this mean for the long-suffering residents of Flint? We'll talk with their Congressman Dan Kildee on this latest obstacle for his city. But first, his only opposition bowed out of the race last weekend. Now, University of Michigan Regent Ron Weiser is in line to succeed Ronna Romney McDaniel as the chairman of Michigan's Republican Party. McDaniel, of course, is the new head of the Republican National Committee. Ron Weiser chaired Michigan's GOP from 2009 to 2011, and he was ambassador to Slovakia under President George W. Bush. Ambassador Ron Weiser, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you.
You've already been chair of the Michigan GOP. Why did you feel compelled to say, all right, I'm willing to take the job again?
Duty, not desire.
Why so?
Well, I worked hard in 2009 and 10 to turn this, what is normally a blue state, to a red state, and I think that in 2018, it's going to be a very difficult election cycle, and so felt it was important that we had somebody there who had the experience and background and management skills to do it again.
What do you see as the challenges that face Michigan's Republican Party?
You've got some of the challenges that are more historical in nature. I mean, we've had to flip over from Democrat to Republican in governorships, so you have that naturally going against you. And then the second thing you have is, it's the second year of a new president's term, and generally the elections go against that president's party, at least historically, again, for a number of cycles.
How do you feel that you can guide the party in preparing for that challenge come the midterms?
Well, I can't tell all the secrets. but basically speaking, you know, putting together a mission, which is clear, and then strategy and tactics, and unifying the party so it's all working together. You know, we can't fight each other, which there's been a tendency to do in both parties. We can't fight each other. We have to be focused on winning. That's what my job is, to keep everybody focused and make sure we have the resources to win.
Let's talk about some of that fighting, because certainly we saw outspoken Republicans in Michigan during the election who said they could not get behind Donald Trump. So how divided do you think the Republican Party is in our state right now?
I don't think it's all that divided. The concern I have is the issue of people who are Trump people or Tea Party people and, quote, whatever the establishment is, which I've never quite figured out what that definition is. I think it's the people who have been around longer. You know, As I said to somebody who was a Trump person, is stay around another 6 years and you'll be establishment too.
President Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus, and the chief strategist, Steve Bannon, endorsed you for the position as the chair of Michigan's party. What communication do you expect to have with the Trump administration and the White House?
Obviously, there's a huge advantage of us having our current state chair, who just left, to become the national chair. And we'll have a close working relationship between the RNC and, you know, the RNC. Reince did a great job there in organizing things as far as data and outreach and some of the things that are the blocking and tackling that win elections. And I worked with him for 2 years in 11 and 12 as his national finance chair when he first became chair. So I know him well, and I obviously know the new chair, Ronna McDaniel.
So that you feel that the ties are strong. And,
yes.
And what will that mean for Michigan's Republicans?
Probably more support from the RNC, perhaps, than we might have gotten otherwise. There'll be a trust because you have every state in the country asking for resources. The people who they think have the best opportunity to win, where those resources can make a difference, is where they're going to go. And I'm hopeful that we can put together a strategy and tactics that can convince them that this is a place where we have great opportunity.
How aligned, Ambassador, are you, or do you plan to be, with the Trump administration on particularly domestic policy issues as you move forward? I mean, is there an opening for divergent views?
I think there is, and quite frankly, my focus as the chair is not going to be on issues and policy. My focus is going to be on putting together a winning team and having the right resources, strategies, and tactics to win.
But when you think of differing opinions even now among the GOP in Michigan and business leaders, a core support group and things like free trade and NAFTA, we got Michigan companies doing a lot of business with Canada and Mexico. Do you see it, any part for you in diverging from the president's agenda, knowing that we may have some core supporters?
I don't think it makes any difference whether I diverge or not because I have no power in those areas and he does. And certainly our business leaders seem to be getting along fine with them because there's pluses and minuses. I think there will be some negatives, but I also think they're going to get some benefits from the changes that he's going to try to bring about that's going to create a lot of jobs for Michigan. And if he's successful in doing that and those jobs can be created in the short term, then that's going to vastly affect the election outcome and be a great benefit for us as a state party.
Right now, certainly the Republican Party is sitting very high with President Trump in the White House, and the party has control of Congress, certainly here in Michigan, the governorship and state government. So you own successes, but you own challenges and problems too. So if you were to look at those challenges and problems that you want to tackle, spell those out for us.
Well, these challenges are challenges and problems that the government has to address. They're not ones that the state party can address. I mean, we certainly can encourage the state party, but jobs and upward mobility are very, very important things for people today. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that have been left behind as the changes have taken place, and certainly not all caused by trade or those sorts of issues. I mean, obviously, technology has left a lot of people behind. So we have a major problem in education still that has to be solved. We need to make sure that our young people are prepared to go into a 21st century world. And I mean, if you think about it now, the kids that are in school are going to be finishing their jobs in 2070. Just think of what the world will be like then. And it's certainly not going to be the way we've been preparing them up to now that they'll be able to have jobs through 2070.
That is kind of a jolt as you say that. And you know what? You're absolutely right. Are you going to continue as a University of Michigan regent doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the university is a very important catalyst to economic growth here in the state and certainly its ability to provide really changes not just to people in the state but to people in the world through its research and some of the things that it accomplishes. We have to make sure that the quality of this university stays at the level that it's been and hopefully maybe even improves.
When you think of chair of the Michigan GOP, what's your personal mission statement? What do you
– win fair and square. That's it. When in 2010 I put together a mission statement and I had a one-page that was a mission statement, strategies and tactics. I won't go into the strategies and tactics because some will be the same and I'm not going to share them. But the mission was really clear. It was two words, win in 10. That was it. That was the mission.
Looking at the upcoming race for governor, the Democrats are saying the very same thing because, of course, of the redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
To the mattresses on both sides?
Yeah, well, of course, redistricting doesn't affect the governor's race, only the state house and Senate races. But you know, we have some negatives because of Flint and some of the other things that have taken place. And they've got some negatives because people felt they've been left behind. And I think this is going to be a battleground state just as it was for the presidency. And you remember how close it was for the presidency, less than 10,000 votes. So it could be that here. And therefore, the ground game is going to be very, very important. When you have close elections, that's the only time it really matters. And this is going to be a close election, I think, up and down the line.
What do you see as some of the negatives that have happened and that you want to have a course adjustment?
Well, some of them, there's nothing that as a party we can do anything about. I mean,
as a committed Republican.
Well, I mean, I think that and I'm hopeful that the people of Flint are given the kind of support and relief they need so that they can live reasonable lives without fear for their children. I mean, that's pretty obvious to me. And I wish it had happened faster. I'm sure that Governor Snyder wished it had happened faster. I wish the mistakes that weren't made, but people are people and they make mistakes. And unfortunately, these were life-changing mistakes. And we've seen that happen before. I mean, some of them are being charged with criminal activity or for negligence or whatever the different charges are, malfeasance office. I don't even know what all the charges are. And whether they are guilty of that will be up to the jury of their peers. But I think it's unfortunate things like this happen. There was only one good thing that came out of Flint, and that's understanding that we have this problem in more than Flint. We have it all over the state. And addressing that is going to be a major problem for, I think, the Trump administration that has talked about the importance of renewing our infrastructure. We've got it in roads and bridges, and we have it in our water supplies and our sewers. I mean, There are a lot of problems that haven't been addressed for a long time, and I think it's probably time that we do that. And how to do that without taking taxes to a level that are unreasonable is going to be a difficult thing. I mean, keeping taxes as they are and reallocating them and spending money more wisely is something that I think is important. And so that's what the job of the governor is and the legislature. And fortunately, it's not the job of the state party chair. But I certainly won't be encouraging them to try to keep the cost down, because people who are struggling to make ends meet can't necessarily pay more taxes. And I know it's easy to talk about, well, it's just a little bit more here and it's a little bit more there. And I see that in the millages at times. And for people who are living on the edge, that can make a difference in their lives.
I know it's only been a few days, but how would you assess the beginning of the new Trump administration? I mean, the new president has already made quite a few headlines.
Well, the things that he's done have been, I think, things that many people in the country are pleased with. The things that he's said are not things that are necessarily things that everybody in the country is pleased with.
How so?
Well, I mean, he's the tweet master of all times. And I mean, I'm not going to be critical of our president, because I'm more interested in what he does, not what he says. But I mean, he's made some claims that are really have nothing to do with the future of the country. And, you know, those are not things that should be a focus of his administration. And I don't think they are, because certainly the actions he's taking are ones that are significant for a lot of people. I think that they're going to create a lot of jobs.
Well, when you talk about things that are being said or tweeted, when you've got, for example, the claims of voter fraud, that's a pretty stupendous 3 to 5 million illegal votes. It's a pretty stupendous claim. And you've got even House Speaker Paul Ryan saying there's no proof of that. And Senator Lindsey Graham said these claims are undermining faith in our democracy.
Yeah, well, there probably is some voter fraud in some places, and I'm not sure where. I mean, I'm sure the Secretary of State's office will be looking into those, and we'll see whether there were or not.
The 3 to 5 million is a pretty stupendous claim.
Yeah, I don't know where the number comes from.
Ambassador Ron Weiser, the new chair of the Michigan GOP, soon to be named new chair, made it official. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on Stateside. Thank you. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy birthday, Michigan. It was 180 years ago today, January 26, 1837. Michigan became a state, the 26th state to join the Union. But before that could happen, there was some housekeeping to do, namely settle the fight between Michigan and Ohio over a little strip of land called the Toledo Strip. With us now from the Michigan History Center is our state archivist, Mark Harvey. Mark, we know this is the Toledo War, but is that term really accurate?
I think it is. It was a dispute over that stretch of land around Toledo, and it was a armed insurrection or armed conflict.
Now, no one died, right?
No one died. No. There's been legends over the years that the only casualty was a pig. I think that's been disproven, although it's a great story.
It is a good story.
Also that another Ohioan had gotten in a fight in a tavern and was stabbed. So those are things that are just good stories, but there were no casualties.
So when and why did this fight start brewing? I mean, what was the big deal over this site where Toledo sits today?
The dispute went all the way back to the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, where some not very good surveying instructions said that the boundary of the state would be drawn from the southern point of Lake Michigan all the way due east. And that's where the dispute came in, is whether that included Toledo or not. Some thought it went to the mouth of the Maumee River. Some thought it just went straight across. And so that's where the dispute stemmed from, and early maps all showed Toledo as part of Michigan, and we have letters addressed to Toledo, Michigan in the collection.
And my understanding is Ohio kind of outmuscled Michigan. It had more clout in Washington than Michigan did.
Yeah, they became, you know, as much as we don't like to admit it, they became a state before us. So they had representatives in Congress. We were still a territory. We became a territory the same year they became a state. So we had less sway, obviously, because we didn't have representation. But despite that, we went ahead and just ratified our own constitution and elected a governor anyway.
But Michigan really couldn't become a state till all of this was settled, and there were tensions. I understand you have some letters. Who are these letters from that you have?
Well, they're from all different people, but the particular one I brought with me today was from George R. Griswold. So if you're familiar with Detroit street names, that name will jump out. And he became our first clerk of the House and a legislator after that. But at the time, in 1835, he was the captain of the Detroit Rifle Corps.
Okay. So was he talking smack about the Buckeyes?
A little bit. He wrote a letter to His Excellency Stevens T. Mason, our governor, also nicknamed the boy governor because he was so young.
Yeah.
And he wrote him this letter, which I can just read for you.
Sure.
It says, "Should the crisis arrive in which it would be deemed necessary for the maintenance of our laws and the protection of our citizens to require military aid from the arrogant encroachments of Ohio, be pleased to accept in the name and on behalf of the members of the Detroit Rifle Corps their undivided services in defense of our rights."
Those arrogant encroachers in Ohio.
Yeah, they're still up to that.
Now, it all got settled, didn't it, by what? Clearly we know Ohio got Toledo, and what? We got the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, at the time on maps it was listed as no man's land, so it was sort of a, you know, bittersweet. We grudgingly took the UP only to find out later that it was filled with, you know, vast wealth of copper and iron ore, so it worked out for us.
And I'm wondering how the folks living in the Upper Peninsula felt. Were they happy about becoming part of Michigan, or was that maybe not such a great thing for them?
Last I checked, I think they would prefer to be the state of Superior, but you know, that's an ongoing debate.
You know, it is interesting, Mark. It seems like a funny little war, but it does show us that it's a challenge to keep things smooth between the states. And you think about it, it was just 24 years later, we had the Civil War.
Yeah, I think it's after 180-plus years, it's easy to chuckle at it. But I think it's also important to remember that there were people lined up across the field with weapons ready to do battle over this important, what they thought at the time was a vital port that would lead to the Mississippi River.
Mark Harvey is our state archivist, and we're glad you were with us, Mark, to kind of help us mark Michigan's 180th birthday and filling us all in on the Toledo War. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
Michigan's philanthropic organizations are facing a changing climate of giving. The movement of money within the nation's wealthiest families, low wages for many of today's young people, political polarization, and the erosion of government safety nets. All of these have an impact on how people give and how charities organize themselves. Today's contributor to The Next Idea has been watching these trends and others that affect charitable giving. Kyle Caldwell is the executive director of the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley State University. Kyle, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you.
You recently released a white paper that explores important trends affecting philanthropy. And one trend that really jumped out is that the wealthiest people in America are passing along, what, some $59 trillion between the generations between 2007 until 2061. What do you think that'll mean for philanthropy?
Well, it's going to really change the way philanthropy thinks about its work. First, this transfer in terms of the dollars is one of the more massive transfers we've ever seen. We're already seeing an increase in the number of foundations, an increase in the way foundations are organized, or not only private foundations, community foundations, family foundations forming, but we're also seeing, as we've seen with the Chan Zuckerberg couple, them creating a philanthropic vehicle that's for profit. And so I think the transfer itself, in terms of the dollars and the mechanisms, are going to be different. The second is that the generation that currently holds this wealth is passing it on to a generation that thinks about philanthropy, social change, deeds for good in a very different way. They want to do well while doing good, and they conflate their work life with their philanthropic life. They don't think it's a matter of earning it and then giving it away. They want to do it simultaneously. We're seeing that this generation is less into investing in institutions and more in direct causes. They want to be hands-on. They want to be involved with the change that they want to see driven through their wealth. So not only is the money and the mechanisms changing, but the way this generation and the generations to come think about philanthropy is going to be very different. And I think you'll see changes in the nonprofit sector, changes in the philanthropic sector that will obviously align with those changes.
So as the wealthiest people in America are passing along these trillions to their grown children, on the other end of the wealth spectrum, we have a lot of young people today who do not have as much disposable income as mom and dad did. So how do philanthropic organizations compensate for that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the two ends of this opportunity and challenge is that with this great wealth, there is also this great wealth disparity. There is this increasing gap between those that have and those that have not. And I think what's going to change here is the resources that are being channeled through the philanthropic sector are going to be pressured to deal with that income inequality, that the equity gap. There's education opportunities that this generation is wrestling with, affordability of education, and especially as the expectations of higher education grow, a master's degree seems to be, you know, the lever to greater success. It's not just a bachelor's degree or not just a high school diploma. I think philanthropy is going to be pressured to figure that out. I think there's going to be an increased pressure in figuring out the social compact, that agreement between government and philanthropy that says that there are some things that government can do well, there are some things that the nonprofit sector can do well, and the partnership that needs to be formed in order to provide critical services to communities is, I think, going to increase pressure on philanthropy as the budget gets readjusted, as we look at a new administration that's really interested in trimming back public funding. I think the third thing that we're going to see is an increased awareness of this disparity. I think there's been a feeling in our country, and certainly, you know, even globally, that we all can contribute, and that is true. Through our time, our talent, and our treasure, we all can contribute in some way. But I think what we're seeing is the stark difference between those who can contribute more and those who have to make hard choices about whether or not they fortify themselves or they give to others. So as we look at the income disparities, I think those pressures are going to come to bear, and it's going to affect both how the nonprofit sector and government think about their roles.
I'm talking with Kyle Caldwell, who's the executive director of the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley State University, as we look at philanthropy in the future. And you've kind of touched on, as government adjusts its priorities, where the philanthropic community could step in. And my goodness, we certainly have seen that in a lot of headlines where foundations have come in. For example, in the Flint water situation, certainly Detroit's Grand Bargain would not have ever come together without foundation dollars. Is the nonprofit world becoming society's safety net?
I think it's always been a safety net. I think what we're seeing now is a conflation between the role that philanthropy can play to be a incubator and support mechanism for communities and the role that government has traditionally taken on. So when we look at the Detroit bankruptcy, that, as you pointed out, resolution to the bankruptcy, the largest single municipal bankruptcy in the country, resolved in record time. And it was only because the Detroit Institute of Arts and some of the other nonprofit assets related to that got thrown on the table, so that philanthropy and the nonprofit sector was forced to be in that conversation in a way that was problem solving. And now you have a nonprofit that is actually paying pensioners, so taking on literally a public sector role. I think when we look at the Flint water crisis, the first dollars in were from private foundations and the local community foundation to really ameliorate some of the effects of lead and really thinking about the health conditions of children and their future and the education opportunities that they'll have. But the state then came in, both in state and federal dollars, to help support the recovery efforts. So philanthropy being the first one in, as a first responder, is a new role. I think we can also look at other opportunities that philanthropy has played in helping government. When we think about the Kalamazoo Promise, you know, here you have five anonymous donors throwing money in the pool to help provide universal higher education access for Kalamazoo graduates to any Michigan public or private higher ed institution. In addition, we are seeing it sort of the second wave of that, with this large contribution of funding to the city to help stabilize the tax base.
Yes, that's striking with a $70.3 million donation that was driven by lead donors William Parfit and William Johnston, and now trying to stabilize the city's finances, but they're also starting a capital campaign to get more money for the city's budget.
Absolutely. I think the goal that I, the last goal I saw was nearly $500 million. And it's also not only to provide stabilization to the tax base, the property tax base, but also to provide some skunk work dollars to think about new innovations in the city in the future. So here you have private contributions going to stabilize the tax base as well as provide some of the venture capital that the city will need to think about new ideas and grow.
But is this sustainable and realistic?
I think these are really exciting times to view the role. I think what we're all seeing here is sort of the wild, wild west. And there aren't a lot of ground rules for how both philanthropy and government will stand in this role. And there certainly aren't bright lines between where philanthropy will stop and government expectations will go forward. So I think we do run the risk of scale being an issue. So one of the things that I always talk about is if you look at Michigan, it has a strong and robust philanthropic sector. We have some of the largest private foundations in the world housed in our state. And if you took all of their assets, not just what they pay out in grants and the interest dividends, but all of their assets and all of the assets of all the community foundations, which cover the entire state, every community has access to a community foundation, and you throw in the family foundations and the corporate foundations, put it in a pool, and you hand it over to the state of Michigan and say, run state government with no other public funding but our own contributions, that money would be gone in 6 months.
Wow.
So you cannot scale on the backs of philanthropy. What you can do is use philanthropy to think about ways of incubating new ideas, but the scaling and the sustainability will have to come from other forces, whether it's market forces in the for-profit sector or government.
Kyle, I don't need to tell you, we are all very aware of the fact that our nation right now is extremely polarized. So I'm wondering, in this environment, what advice would you give Michigan's nonprofits going forward? How can they be successful in this state, in this country, in this time in history?
The nonprofit sector, especially 501c3 charities, have a unique skill set and a unique asset, and that is that they are by law required to be nonpartisan. So they are the perfect player to bring diverse voices together to find common cause to community solutions. And they cannot take a bias because they will lose their nonprofit status. So they can stand in some of these polarized situations. When we talk about education reform, when we talk about public safety issues, and we talk about economic development, the nonprofit organizations are on the ground. They are doing the work. So they can bring together government and bring together business and bring together local citizens and say, what are the challenges that we see and what are the ways that we can engage? C3 organizations are also perfect foils for not only the conversations, but the ways that we can identify new and innovative ways for community problem solving. So when a community comes together and they say, these are the things that we need to do, nonprofits are often well-placed to actually be the delivery system for some of those solutions. But what they need is strong partnerships from government. They need strong partnerships with business in order to make that happen. So I think they can play a very fundamental bridging role in these polarized conditions that we're dealing with. The second thing that I say that is really important for the nonprofit sector is to really understand their voice. I think we talked about it earlier that there is going to be a large shift in public funding, either by moving money to block granting to states and local communities or making reductions in overall spending. Those pressures then are going to come down to the community in a way that we haven't seen in quite some time, where local communities who are not actually doing all that well right now as far as the shift in the tax base as it looks in Michigan already, to see a further shift, they're going to need to rely on nonprofits. And nonprofits are going to have to really use their voice to say, these are the consequences for these spending priorities. Here's how we can help, but here are the places where investment is needed. And they can use that voice because they are able to talk about policy and they are able to talk about some of the ramifications without being seen as partisan.
Opportunities and challenges for Michigan's philanthropic organizations looking into the future. Kyle Caldwell is Executive Director of the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy at Grand Valley State University. Kyle, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your ideas on The Next Idea.
Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every year, the EPA awards over $4 billion in grants and other means of assistance. Within hours of President Trump taking the oath of office, an email went out to EPA officials ordering them to freeze all contract and grant awards effective immediately. So would that affect federal aid to Flint? Senators Debbie Stabenow, Gary Peters, and Flint's Congressman Dan Kildee put that question to President Trump in a letter they sent to the White House. Congressman Dan Kildee is with us now. It took a lot of heavy lifting, Congressman, to get that aid approved last month by Congress. How much are we talking about?
Well, it's $170 million in this total package, $100 million directly for Flint's infrastructure, some other support for health and development, and creating a registry for the people who have been affected. It was a significant amount of money, and that's why we were so concerned when President Trump made this pronouncement. Not only did he put a halt to EPA grants, but he also prevented EPA from making any announcements or sharing information, and that, of course, raised a lot of alarm bells for us. We're now starting to get indications, some reassuring indications, that the fund through which the Flint infrastructure money will flow will not be held up. But there are other aspects of EPA's support for Flint that could be. So we're still a little bit anxious about this, but some reassurance that the money that we appropriated late last year will still be on its way to Flint.
And I'm sure there has to be concerns if I'm someone living in Flint and I want some information. You've got to be wondering, can an EPA official release that information under these tighter new rules?
Well, yeah, that was one of the concerns I had about the gag rule that the president put on the EPA. I mean, one question I had is whether that would prevent the EPA from fulfilling its obligation under the new Kildee-Upton law that says that if the EPA knows about lead or copper in a water system and it's not public, the EPA has to go public within 24 hours. If they can't issue press releases, if they can't issue statements, can they comply with their obligation under the law to keep people safe by giving them the information that they need? You know, obviously the Flint money is our core concern, but this approach that the president is taking is very concerning.
Have you had any response from the White House?
Not directly from the White House, although there was a statement that was allowed to be released by an EPA official that gave some assurance that the Clean Drinking Water Revolving Loan Funds, which is the path through which the Flint grant passes, will continue to be administered. But we're looking for a specific and direct response from the White House to provide complete clarity.
And have you been able to have any direct communication with people in the EPA since the inauguration?
Not directly, no. That's part of the difficulty. Our staff has talked to the regional staff at the EPA. We have good relationships there, but we haven't had a formal response from them. But we worked with these folks for a year and a half, so I think there's some trust there. And our hope is that those folks who were doing a really good job won't be prevented from continuing to do that job.
We have seen past administrations come in and put temporary freeze on contracts and grants in the past to give everything going over. Is that right?
That's true. And of course, that's where it was a little confusing the way President Trump singled out EPA and specifically not only prevented them from going forward on new contracts, but appropriations of Congress. You know, that's a legislative initiative. That's a legislative prerogative. We don't believe the president should have the authority to prevent those dollars from being expended. But it was made more difficult by the president also basically preventing people across departments from issuing any sort of statements. Those statements could be reassuring to communities like Flint that are really concerned about whether the freeze that he has announced could affect help that is headed their way. So it was the combination of the two that really got our attention.
I got to ask you, Congressman, this kind of thing we're talking about, the gagging federal employees, now we're seeing alternate rogue Twitter feeds popping up from different, particularly scientific federal agencies, or the president's fixation about the size of his inauguration and his surrogates pushing inaccurate facts as alternative truths. I got to wonder, what are you hearing from your colleagues on the Hill about this? Not so much the policy, but the behavior.
Well, it's bizarre. I mean, there's no two ways to put it. I could try to be more diplomatic, but You know, the way the president approaches his job is very unusual. This obsession with false facts, with what now, you know, alternative facts, I guess they're coming up with, about the size of the crowd at the inauguration. I've been to 6 inaugurations. I know just from my own experience, his crowd was about half the size of President Obama's. Fine, he's still president. I mean, what's the big deal? He seems to have an obsession about these sorts of things. You know, there are other concerns. The way he's describing the voter turnout in the election results, the assertion that 5 million Americans cast votes illegally, there's no evidence to support that at all. And now he wants to launch a major investigation. My view is, if he wants to investigate the election process in America, have at it, but just make sure you're also investigating efforts that Republicans have used every election that I can recall to try to suppress voter turnout in Democratic performing areas. If they want to go at that issue and be honest and open about it, have at it. But he shouldn't use the government as a source of capacity to buffer his apparently weakened ego. He's the president of the United States. Someday, he's got to grow up and accept the fact that he has huge responsibilities that go beyond making himself feel good every day.
What are you hearing from Republican colleagues? Are they sharing misgivings?
Privately, absolutely. Just as they did during the campaign, they're sharing those misgivings privately. Here's what I hope, I pray, that if a moment occurs where his embrace of falsehoods goes beyond stroking his own ego and could have some impact on real public policy questions or the safety of the country or the planet, that those Republicans who are privately sharing their concerns will have the courage to stand up and challenge him directly. I hope that the necessity for that does not come to pass, but if it does, we are going to be depending on reasonable Republicans, thoughtful Republicans, of which there are many, who are willing to put their duty to country and their loyalty to their country and their constituents ahead of the president or of their party.
Just circling back to Flint, if for some reason that money is either slow to come to Flint or doesn't come at all, how would you be able to respond?
I would go to my Republican colleagues who worked very closely with me. 101 of them voted for the amendment that I and John Molinar offered to provide Flint funding. I would go to them and ask them to join me in pushing the president to support what was a bipartisan effort to deal with this critical problem and to try to not, you know, fall into the typical pattern of turning it into a partisan question. The solution back in 2016 was bipartisan, and if it is threatened, I hope that the support for that initiative would continue to be a bipartisan effort.
Flint Congressman Dan Kildee, thank you so much for being with us, Congressman.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Immigration, the wall, and sanctuary cities were in the spotlight Wednesday in Washington. President Trump signed executive orders enabling construction of the wall along our border with Mexico and targeting sanctuary cities where local leaders refused to hand over undocumented immigrants to be deported. The city of Ypsilanti is in the process of passing 2 ordinances that just could put it on a collision course with the president's policy. The mayor of Ypsilanti is here with us now, Amanda Edmonds. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Describe to us, break down these 2 ordinances. What are you doing with them?
Sure. Well, one is an ordinance long on our books that we have just added to. So our non-discrimination ordinance in the city of Ypsilanti was one of the first in the state and is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. We are so excited that even though it's 20 years old, it keeps changing and adapting keeping with the times. So we, council has recently passed and updated to the ordinance to add gender identity and immigration status to the list of protected classes.
So giving you what? Give us a sense of what the ordinance now would cover.
Anyone in the city. It doesn't just apply to city government. It applies to public accommodations, to employment, to housing. So if any of those list of protected classes feel like they've been discriminated against in any setting in our city limits, they can come and make a complaint to our city attorney. And there is various outcomes, but the most severe would be up to a $500 fine.
So when you talk about the classes and groups of people who are now covered, it would entail what?
It includes race, it includes ethnicity, it includes nationality, it includes many of the lists that you see mm-hmm. on many non-discrimination statements and ordinances, but now it includes gender identity. It's had sexual orientation for a long, long time, was one of the first in the state, but it's expanding to include gender identity and immigration status, which are things that weren't as known or relevant or as...
The awareness wasn't the same.
The awareness wasn't the same about those needing to be protected classes. One thing that's important is because there are not always state and federal protections for all the classes in our ordinance. We are showing that people who live in, visit, traverse through our community are going to be protected.
And the second?
The second is a non-solicitation and anti-profiling ordinance. And that's really increasing our protection for people regardless of their immigration status. So what that does, and we've modeled that off of the City of Detroit's ordinance, and that was under the recommendation of the Michigan Center for Immigrant Rights, who is really a leader in the state. So Detroit has had an ordinance on the books for a long time. We took most of the language and adapted it for our own needs. And it really says that no one from the city, and that includes city officials, elected officials, staff, that of course includes our police department, any other city staff, but also volunteer members of boards and commissions, and people who act as city contractors who really represent the city in their role with us. None of those folks can ask immigration status except for under a very specific sort of set of circumstances.
What would that be?
Some of the examples of that is if someone is applying for employment and they need to complete an I-9. Immigration status is something on that. There are times when immigration status is relevant to criminal prosecution. It is not relevant to a traffic ticket. It is not relevant when someone comes forward to say they've been a victim of a crime or they have information related to a crime. So there is still a willingness and a need in that to cooperate as we can with federal law enforcement. That's something that Detroit's ordinance does have. But there are so many times when it is not relevant for anyone to ask immigration status, and we are making sure that everyone who represents the city beyond law enforcement knows that.
What drove this? Why now, particularly the second one regarding immigration status?
Well, we know that the state and the national discourse right now is creating a culture of fear, is creating not just a culture, but a very real fear. We had a young woman who may have been 10 or 11 years old, get up at city council last night, started crying, talking about the fear that she and her family have when they are pulled over by the police for a traffic ticket or a taillight out, etc., not knowing what's going to happen to them. I mean, that is not a fear that we want in our community. And that was very real. We heard from many people, documented, undocumented, other community supporters from Ypsilanti and beyond, that we want to live in a community where, despite all of the other fears people have, that this is one that they could set aside.
Does this make Ypsilanti a sanctuary city?
You know, there's no legal definition of sanctuary city.
What's your version of a sanctuary city? Your thoughts?
There's no one legal definition, but it is a place that we are offering extra protection. So if I'm using just my mm-hmm. definition of sanctuary, then we are making people know that they can feel safe and protected in every way that in our city government's domain that we can protect them.
So is that a yes? Do you feel, in your mind, when you think of Ypsilanti, is it a sanctuary city?
It's a place where people feel safe and welcoming. I mean, in reality, we have to be careful about using this word sanctuary,
sure.
right? Some cities have signed up in a very official way under a certain set of guidelines, and this addresses what we're putting forward, some of those, mm-hmm. but there's not some one definition. And because of the threats of both federal and state funding that are how cities operate and exist to give services to our community, we have to be careful about those labels. But I'm not shy being on a statewide radio show about saying that we are putting forth these ordinances in these ways, and we are not going to stop here.
And so let's talk about some of the language that we've heard, starting first on the national level with President Trump saying he's going to rescind federal funding from these sanctuary cities. And his executive order that he signed this week certainly amps up the possibility of repercussions. Does this concern you? Does Ypsilanti rely on a lot of federal funding?
We have federal funding, but as a smaller city, less that comes through directly, comes through various other fiduciaries at the state level and the local level. So how that would actually play out, especially to a smaller community like us, hard to say. But right now, what's important in the threat of state and federal sanctions in these ways is that we all stand strong, that as many communities around the state as possible stand strong and say, we are not going to put up with this. We know millions and millions of people marched across the country very recently to say, we are not going to put up with this. And that is our role as leaders in our local communities and as collectives of local and state communities around the country right now.
We're talking with Ypsilanti Mayor Amanda Edmonds about the two new ordinances that are being processed right now that will certainly increase protections for immigrants. And let's talk about on the state level, Mayor. We've got Republican State Representative Pamela Hornberger, who represents parts of St. Clair and Macomb County, preparing to introduce a bill that would ban cities from becoming sanctuary cities in our state. What are your thoughts about Lansing enacting a ban on cities from becoming sanctuary cities?
Well, we think that that is something to be very worried about in our current state political climate, but we're not stopping. And Detroit has already had this on the books. Really, you're going to come for Detroit and cut state funding, because that is the threat, as we've seen in this bill, not yet introduced. That is the threat that state revenue sharing, which is how cities are funded, would be cut. Well, we also know that state revenue sharing mandated already has been cut to cities around the state to the tune of about $1.2 million a year for the city of Ypsilanti. So we've seen those threats of cuts anyway. We're not going to let this new threat stop us. And we're, again, going to hope cities all over and communities and townships all over the state, you know, band together and say, this is not the Michigan that we represent.
How long will it take, do you think, to have everything pushed through and everything approved?
Yeah, so we've got the updates to our non-discrimination ordinance are approved. So those go into effect in the end of February. We would expect with the process we're partly through with the non-solicitation and anti-profiling ordinance to be through and would go into effect beginning of March.
Ultimately, what do you hope these ordinances mean for the people who live in Ypsilanti?
I want to not have young children coming and crying at city council because they're afraid for their families. Whether or not they are documented, people are feeling afraid, and we want a community that people feel safe and welcome in. Ypsilanti prides itself on its diversity, and we are only going to continue to be diverse if we can make a community, whether it's our university community, our school system community, or the city itself. But what's important is that people say Ypsilanti, and they don't know that they're in the city of Ypsilanti or necessarily Ypsilanti Township. There's not red lines or blue lines drawn on the street. So it's important that we go beyond our borders and really work with our neighbors throughout the county. There's 28 units of government, local units of government in Washtenaw County, and make sure that as people move across these borders, as they do every day, that they don't aren't feeling scared because they may have crossed that municipal jurisdiction line.
Ypsilanti Mayor Amanda Edmonds, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.